From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. This week, we welcome Peter Ames Carlin back to the show. We last spoke with him a while back when his fine biography of Brian Wilson, Catch a Wave, was published. His latest book is a biography of Paul McCartney, who played bass with a group of lads from Liverpool. The book is called McCartney, A Life. Peter Ames Carlin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me back.
You know, for many years, even before John Lennon's death, I found myself in the position of Paul McCartney defender. For some reason, people have a misconception that John did everything great in the Beatles and Paul was the corny, syrupy, sweet one. And many of these people say they can't stand his solo work. And then I ask, well, you know, are you familiar with Flowers in the Dirt or Chaos in Creation or Back to the Egg or Flaming Pie or Memory Almost Full? And they tell me, no, that they've never listened to any of Paul's work, and they wouldn't, you know. And it's interesting because people who love Paul mostly love John too, but a lot of Lennon fans feel the need to despise McCartney. What do you think accounts for this?
Well, you know, to some extent, it comes down to, you know, the mythology that always gets built around super famous people. You know, who seem, I think, to most people, less like humans themselves and more like these kind of, you know, sort of glittering abstractions for, you know, larger ideas or feelings that they already have about stuff. But on the other hand, you know, but also with Paul in particular, I think that he does himself, a disservice often when it comes to, you know, presenting himself as this very sleek and sort of, you know, breezy guy who never really has a tough time. I mean, John so very famously said at one point in the early 70s that genius is pain. And I think he was talking in regard to himself, you know, to some degree at least, that the idea, you know, that what he understood about his creativity is that the headwaters of it rested in, you know, this feeling of unsettledness inside of him and the, you know, the pain that he'd experienced as a child, you know, that you process, you know, trying to transcend from that. You filter these things through your muse and it becomes art and it's beautiful and you know, but it's the very sort of powerful and unsettled feelings that create the greatest art. And he's right to a great extent. And I think Paul would probably agree with him, but Paul's other impulse as somebody who grew up as the son of a jazz musician who was very focused on, you know, stagemanship and being kind of, you know, this very sort of pop audience-friendly type of character. I think Paul grew up with the idea that he needed to keep those kinds of darker feelings hidden from people, that part of being a successful showman, even if you were creating brilliant work, as he believes he has done over the years, is to present it with a smile and to make people feel comfortable and happy and to create this kind of cheerful, you know, catalog of music that elevates people above their problems rather than sort of, you know, digging deeper into them. You know, and to a great extent, yeah, he has probably erred, you know, creatively on the side of making things seem a lot more breezy and easy than they actually are. But he also has had times in his career, particularly after his life has had, you know, taken a bad turn with the death of John, for instance, or the death of his wife Linda, and elsewhere, where he's really delved into the deeper, darker, uglier feelings and really tried to process that stuff through his art, and has been remarkably successful doing so.
Well, in the way that he deals with pain is just certainly so much different than the way John does, but, you know, I guess the album that you write about in the book and that we know that deals with the most pain for Paul is that album Run, Devil, Run, which has all these happy-go-lucky rock and roll covers.
It does to an extent, except that he performs them. I mean, there's nothing happy-go-lucky with the way that he sings those songs. I mean, there's a kind of poignance, you know, in some places, and this fierce, you know, rage that's filtered into others. It's just like the most unrelentingly hard-rocking album he's really ever made. And you can hear him. I mean, he sings that album with so much passion and so much fire. He sounds like a good 30 years younger than he was at the time that he recorded the record. And you can see, I mean, despite the fact that he only wrote 3 of the 12 or 13 songs that are on that album, and the rest are these old, you know, sort of rock and roll obscurities to a large extent. You know, these songs are telling his story in that moment, which was, you know, within a year of Linda's death, and trying, you know, his trying to come to terms with this awful thing that's happened to him, and also trying to find a way beyond that.
Book, which is called McCartney, A Life, it was recently reviewed by Suzanne Vega in the New York Times Book Review, and it was not entirely a positive review, although she did say some nice things, but her main problem, I guess, she said, she writes, "What's missing here is the voice of Paul himself. Being unauthorized, the book suffers from an overabundance of secondhand sources and competing flavors of each, and is studded with speculation about what Paul might have said or thought he felt."
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any reaction to her criticism?
Well, you know, it was sort of an odd review, because on the one hand, she said that, but on the other hand, she also said that the book was, you know, lovingly researched and full of great news, you know, great stuff that came out of these people who had grown up around Paul and, you know, had worked with him over the years. So it's hard to know what to make of it. Obviously, Paul didn't grant me an interview, and that was, you know, disappointing to me. But on the other hand, I just redoubled my efforts to talk to, you know, the people who had grown up around him. One of the interesting, you know, who had grown up with him, who had played with him on the stages in Liverpool and Hamburg, and then, you know, been a part of his world through the Beatle era and then beyond, you know, into the Wings era and beyond that. And there were a lot of very, you know, interesting, to my mind, a lot of revelatory stories that come through these people. And often, I think, far more revelatory than what Paul will say for himself. I mean, he really does tend to kind of propagate a sort of mythology about himself, which, on the one hand, you can't blame him. I mean, he's been like one of the most famous people in the world ever since he was 20 years old. And, you know, you gotta preserve some private space. I mean, there's a whole, you know, millions or billions of people can't know you that well. And I think he's seen his story told and retold and distorted so many times that I think it's difficult for him to know what's real and what isn't anymore.
We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin, and his new book is a biography of Paul McCartney called Paul McCartney, A Life. Well, so back to that Suzanne Vega review for just a second. Is it better to have a poor review or no review at all?
Oh, I think it's better to have, like, a review like that, which was, it's disappointing, you know, than to have nobody notice. You know, I mean, and, you know, and she's an interesting person who has an interesting perspective. I mean, I just happen to think, you know, everybody has a very strong perspective on the Beatles. And one of the lessons I've learned over the last few months since the book has come out is that, yeah, there's been a lot of interest. There's been, you know, we've sold a lot of books and licensed it to a lot of different countries and everything. So it's certainly successful. And it's gotten a lot of really nice reviews that I thought were really cool. But it's also gotten a few of these kind of prickly reviews that come from people who, you know, when you read what they have to say, I mean, Suzanne Vega probably less than others, it almost seems like they weren't reading the same book, because everybody comes to this story with a lot of pre-existing conclusions about, you know, and feelings and interpretations of what this band meant and who did what and what this signifies and what this doesn't signify. And so when you come at them with an alternative point of view, it's almost like they can't even begin to, you know, to want to wrap their minds around it. You know, I've had friends of mine who actually said, like, well, you know, I wouldn't read that book. I don't need to know anything about Paul McCartney, you know.
Every day she takes a morning bath, she wets her hair, wraps a towel around her as she's heading for the bedroom chair. It's just another day, slipping into stockings, stepping into shoes, dipping in the pocket of her raincoat. It's just another day.
Well, it's interesting if you look at the just the 10 years after the Beatles. It seems like the one who loved the Beatles the most, Paul McCartney, was the one who needed it the least in terms of producing great work on his own.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think he always felt a little stunned. I mean, he certainly was a hugely successful pop artist in the 70s. But those albums with Wings, I mean, really, he really dialed back his artistic ambitions. And really, even though all those albums really, you know, they've aged, I think, particularly well. A lot of those Wings albums that seemed kind of disposable at the time, you go back to them now, and, you know, the solo stuff from the 70s and then into the Wings era through the late 70s, you know, they all have a scattering of gems on them. I mean, but the problem for people in the 70s was that it was clear that Paul was not trying to, you know, to stand up to something like Abbey Road. I mean, he was making silly, you know, he was making good pop music. And every so often, like with the Band on the Run album, he would aspire to something more. And he would really come up with songs that, you know, that really did have the weight and, you know, the sort of narrative clarity and the kind of daring, you know, musical sense of innovation and, you know, boundary breaking that he'd invested into the Beatles. But then you come across a song like Silly Love Songs, for instance, which is still a beautiful pop track. I mean, it's a lovely song in a lot of ways. Or one of my least favorite singles of his, With a Little Luck, from the London Town album in 1978, where it's essentially like a mission statement that he's not really going to deal with uncomfortable feelings anymore. He gets to that chorus of, you know, the willow turns its back on inclement weather. You know, and if he can do it, we can do it, just you and me. And it's sort of like, what is it? It sounds like a chewing gum commercial.
Well, you are critical of him as a lyricist, I think, in your book. But at the same time, if you think about those songs, Silly Love Songs, Let Him In, and even With a Little Luck, if you listen to them musically, they're pretty adventurous.
Yeah.
Musically. I mean, Silly Love Songs is like a little symphony with these three or four different movements.
Exactly. Plus, also, it has that really bizarro, like, nobody, it's so out of character for that song and what it seems to say that people don't ever really engage in it at all. But it's like, how innovative and weird and cool is that intro with the found sounds?
Yeah.
That little sort of weird, it's kind of like a little collage of percussion sounding instruments that establish the rhythm of the song.
And then
it's like a chainsaw, and like the sound of a chainsaw getting with its little cord getting yanked.
Yeah.
and a whistle, a steam whistle of some sort, and some other piece of machinery that establishes the rhythm that becomes the song, which also has one of the most killer bass lines ever. A lot of other similar moments. I mean, one song that he gets nailed for repeatedly, and I could never figure out why, is a song called Another Day, which was I think his first real serious attempt at a single post Beatles. And it's about a woman working in an office, and she's, you know, sort of isolated. It's about the sort of emotional isolation of this woman. And Denny Seiwell, the drummer for Wings, who was started playing with Paul for the sessions that would become the Ram album, and the first tune they did that he played for them was Another Day. And Denny said to me, and I think he's exactly right, he said they listened to it and all the other musicians stared at each other, because he said that the thought they were sharing was, you know, oh my God, this is Eleanor Rigby in New York. You know, it's got that same sound, you know, it's got that same fairly sort of poignant and very kind of emotionally piercing portrait of this woman who is just being, you know, who is so living this desolate life in the middle of a big city. And, you know, people hit him for it or criticized him because they thought the song was too bourgeois or something. But it's like, you know, I don't quite get where they're coming from. There's nothing pat or easy about that song.
Well, he has always been an artist who takes chances musically. He might be limited as a lyricist, but, you know, the McCartney 2 album, for instance, not just the songs that are on the album, but some of the non-LP singles that he released around that time, like Secret Friend and Check My Machine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are pretty adventurous, kind of avant-garde things. And then, of course, his albums that he did with his group, The Firemen.
Right. Which is, and that was the thing. I mean, one of the ways I sort of end the book, I mean, talk about mythology. One of the interesting things to me about people's interpretations of the book I've just written is that, and Suzanne Vega does this too, she quotes this one bit at that comes near the end of the book, and I'm sort of, the book is, it's kind of the wrap-up section, and I'm taking, and what I'm trying to do is just essentially touch base with the various, you know, the book itself really is about this kind of, not just the paradoxical relationship that John and Paul had and how definitive his relationship with John was and how it continues to shadow him, you know, how John's legacy and the Beatles' legacy in particular, you know, how, what it's like to live your life in the shadow of these things, and, you know, and how it kind of both fuels and distorts the rest of your life. If you're going to put it in a nutshell, it's that. You know, that's what the book is kind of really supposed to be about. And, you know, and all these paradoxical things that go into Paul, like how could the guy that really created Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band also be the guy, you know, who did Ebony and Ivory? You know, I mean, how is this possible? And, you know, people say, like, you know, so you get to the part where this guy is both this very shallow, kind of gratingly cute showman, and on the other hand, he's this tremendously daring avant-garde artist. And so toward the end of the book, I talk about his, you know, dyed hair kind of boy band look that he maintains even as he's pushing 70, and his whole going off every few years and playing a lot of the same Beatles songs and playing them majestically. It's true. But, you know, in releasing these DVDs that kind of focus intently on people bursting into tears or, you know, being moved by the presence of Paul, which I find to be a little, it kind of gets on my nerves a little bit. So I was describing him, sort of his unattractive face, as this kind of aging narcissist. And it's a very dark vision, you know, this guy who's so entranced by his younger face that he can't see how unappealing his older face is becoming. And so, you know, in that nasty, that sort of jagged review, I mean, Suzanne Vega's like, wow, you know, how savage. But on the other hand, it's like, keep reading, because the next 1,500 words is all about, you know, says, on the other hand, there's the Paul who created this Fireman album, Electric Arguments, and just essentially improvised 13 songs, one song a day, and recorded this album, which is just spectacular. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, the performances and just the sense of daring and innovation that goes into creating these songs out of nothing in the morning and leaving in the afternoon with a finished song, and a lot of them are just as sweet and moving and full of emotion and spirit, you know, as a great Beatles song.
Yeah, and I mean, it just shows that he's still growing as an artist. But one of the things that you talk about in the book in his Wings years is you portray him as an artist that's reluctant to improvise, whereas there's a lot of improvisation not only in The Fireman but in his current live show. There's quite a bit of improv.
Does he improv? I mean, because the thing is, one of my disappointments with Paul as an artist is just, you know, I've seen him play a whole lot, you know, over the last 30 odd years. And just like the set list that he's playing, you know, that he'll play tonight in London or wherever he's playing in Europe tonight, is largely the same as the one he played here in Portland in 2002. You know, I mean, he kind of dusts off the same Beatles songs, and you know, I mean, he'll toss in a couple new ones from whatever his latest album is. But there's a lot, you know. I mean, I just, as somebody who has seen this guy play, you know, half a dozen or more, you know, 8-9 times since 1976, I could live the rest of my life and never see him play "Live and Let Die" again and still be happy. You know, I mean, and it's like the pyrotechnic cues are the same as they were on the Wings tour. I swear to God. It's like, it's a cool song and everything, but it's just like, oh man, you know, it's like, enough with this song. And there are certain tunes that he just feels like he's got to play every night, and he keeps his arrangements, at least from what I've seen, you know, his arrangements are usually pretty rigidly tied to the album arrangements. And
well, he doesn't rework them, you know,
right,
the way Bob Dylan would or something like that.
Right, and that's what he says. He goes, well, you know, Dylan does these tunes, and you get halfway through a song, and suddenly you realize, like, oh, that's my favorite song. You know, because he didn't recognize it, because he turned stuff inside out. But my feeling is that, you know, there's a long way between, you know, the alpha of Paul doing note-for-note versions and the omega of Dylan turning things, you know, inside out till the most familiar songs in the world sound completely new to you, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, you could stretch out. It's like you listen to him playing, and he's playing a song like Drive My Car, and you're thinking, like, that's got such a great groove. You know, I would love to just hear him kind of riff on this groove and come up with, like, you know, a slightly different twist on this song. Because those songs are big enough and well-written enough to sustain a lot of experimentation. But he's very, you know, but that's the showman in Paul. I mean, that's the guy who knows that, like, probably 80%+ of his audience wants to hear the note-for-note version. And my sense is, you know, and obviously I'm nowhere near as successful as Paul, so maybe that's evidence, you know, that's strong enough to say which one of us is right. But it's like, man, when I go to a show, I want to see somebody, you know, I kind of want to see things shaken up a little bit. You know, I like to hear my favorite songs, but I like them even more when they suddenly veer off in a direction that I wasn't expecting. You know, every so often he'll stretch out a tune in some unexpected way, but not, you know, not as often as at least I would like.
We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin, and his book is a biography of Mr. Paul McCartney. But I want to ask you about the choices you made in the book. I mean, Paul's in his late 60s now, and the Beatles story, you know, ended in 1970, but it takes up more than half the book. Were you tempted to just sort of start it in 1970, or?
You know, one of the things I thought to myself was, if I were a novelist and I was writing a novel about a guy like Paul McCartney, the book would begin the day after the Beatles break up, because that's when, you know, the guy's character takes on new, unexpected, and fascinating layers. But on the other hand, if you're writing a lifetime biography of Paul McCartney, you got to really give service to his childhood and, you know, the early days, sort of the formation. Sort of, you got to take yourself and your readers to the headwaters of the guy's muse and figure out exactly, because you really are only going to understand what happens after if you really pay attention to, you know, what happened before he ever picked up a guitar. My frustration with a lot of other McCartney books was that they essentially end in 1970. Even many years from now, which is essentially his autobiography as told to Barry Miles, you know, it's an 800-page book, but really only there's maybe 50 or 60 pages that take place after the Beatle breakup. Like, it really just about ends when, you know, in the spring of 1970. And I thought, I was just as fascinated, or even in my own mind more fascinated with, you know, his ongoing relationship with John through the 70s and the relationship he's had with John's ghost since then, you know, since 1980 when he was killed. Because, you know, it's just painful to see this guy being twisted between, you know, wanting to, especially in the days immediately after John's death and, you know, when he was shot down in 1980, you see this guy desperately wanting to pay homage, or, you know, or at least give credit to his best, you know, his friend and partner who was murdered in, you know, the most grotesque way imaginable, and to deal with his own grief and to find a way to, you know, to to comprehend what had happened to, you know, to John and to him in a sense too. But then as the years go on and the months go on and John begins to get deified in this way, you know, you can also sense Paul beginning to freak out a little bit because he's in the worst of all possible situations, which is watching, not, you know, in the the celebration of his partner, he's feeling himself being diminished. And it's true. I mean, people wanted to, there was a period there, I mean, especially like when Philip Norman put out his book, that Shout, the, you know, the Beatle bio from 81 or 82, you know, he basically lays out that John was really the leader of the group and Paul was kind of this super talented functionary who wrote a few decent songs but mostly made the trains run on time. And that's just not true, you know, and if John were there, he would have, you know, if John were here right now, I think he would confirm that. I mean, John was definitely the sort of the intellectual headwaters and kind of created the idea of the Beatles that, you know, that you could be a very thoughtful intellectual artist and yet also invest all that, you know, all that ambition and spirit into rock and roll. That rock and roll was a serious art, you know, serious artistry, and should, and you should take it that seriously and be judged that seriously. But Paul, on the other hand, you know, was this super talented and remains super talented and visionary musician who not only taught John how to tune his guitar, you know, and play guitar chords in the correct way as opposed to the banjo chords that he'd learned from his mother, but also, you know, as the Beatles were progressing sonically and you know, and getting into their experimental period from, you know, say 65 on, a lot of that most serious experimentation with the electronic, you know, backward loops and, you know, the orchestral, the avant-garde sort of orchestral climaxes in A Day in the Life, that's all Paul's business. I mean, he was the one who came into the studio with those ideas. And, you know, and so the great collaboration, I mean, the magic of the Beatles is that collaboration between John and Paul. You know, the fact that John was this restless and, you know, slightly misanthropic and witty and brilliant intellect, and Paul was his, you know, brilliant and witty, you know, musical partner. And John wrote great songs, and Paul can write great lyrics when he puts his mind to it, especially if he knows that they're going to be edited by John Lennon. You know, so they really, it's not like one was completely deficit where the other was strong, but they were both just fantastically strong, almost fully realized artists who made one another, you know, incredibly great.
Their meeting changed our lives.
Exactly, exactly. But again, I mean, talk about mythology. I mean, people talk about the Beatles coming, you know, growing up in the slums of Liverpool, except for the fact that John grew up in a very comfortable suburb, and, you know, the townhouse, even though Paul's council house, you know, that his family lived in was, you know, government-subsidized and working class, it was still, in like, among the nicer council houses that, you know, the Liverpool council had to offer. And when Paul walked over to John's house, I mean, the towpath that led them, the shortest way between Paul's house and John's house, was next to a golf course. It's a very pleasant and leafy suburb in Liverpool where those two guys grew up. So, you know, John was definitely better off than Paul. But you know, they grew up in, you know, despite the emotional angst that they both suffered through, they were not uncomfortable growing up.
Well, Paul McCartney, equally complex character to John, and the book, which deals with some of this complexity, is called Paul McCartney, A Life, and the author is Peter Ames Carlin. Our time has flown, but thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
I really appreciate it, Gary. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I want to thank Peter Ames Carlin for being on the show, and I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks a million, Breanne. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.